All right. Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. We do have a quorum present. Before we start our agenda today, I would like to remind the committee of a few housekeeping items. Everyone in the audience must be seated when they are in the hearing room. Please no standing or sitting in the walkways or in the aisles. This will allow us to keep the accessible seating available for those who need it. Please leave all signs outside the room. All testifiers who have signed up in the advance have been provided time to testify. I do reserve the right as chair of the committee to impose time limits on comments. We do have a full agenda today, so it's quite possible we may have to put time limits on, and that's to make sure that we can that we get our work done that we've got scheduled for the meeting today. We will usually ask the room if there are any further testifiers who would like to speak on a particular issue, but that may not always be possible. Thank you for your understandings and adherence to the rules. And with that, we'll move on to our first item on the agenda, which is the approval of the meeting minutes from our Monday, March 4th meeting. Is there a motion? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves the minutes from March 4th, 2024. Any questions or amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, our first bill on the agenda today is House File 4366 from Representative Edelson. I see she is at the table and ready to present. Representative Edelson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move or refer House File 4366 to the Public Safety and Finance Committee.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. I understand that you also have an author's A1 amendment. Would you please move that and explain the A1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move to incorporate the DE1 author's amendment. If the committee would be so kind to adopt this amendment, I can speak to the overall bill.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Any questions or comments on the DE1 author's amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the DE1 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion is approved and House File 4366 is amended. And as we start this bill, I want to make folks aware that we'd like to wrap this one up by 1:30 to keep on time today. Representative Edelson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4366, as amended, is the Priority Admissions Law, more commonly known as the 48-hour law, was enacted in 2013 and requires the Commission of Human Services to provide individuals being admitted from the county jails to the state-operated treatment facilities. The work of the DE1 so far, I want to be very clear with the committee, is currently in progress. We have another meeting on Friday. We have five stops for committees. We will continue to work on the legislation before you. But just so you know, the work before you is the result of 18 members of the Priority Admission Task Force that started to meet. We passed a task force bill last year in the session, and the recommendations of this report, I believe, came out the first day of session. I do recall reaching out to some of the chairs to make sure they knew that I was going to be starting to work on the bill. The task force representation included hospitals, sheriffs, direct care and treatments, NAMI, community mental health, the omnibus person for mental health, counties, county attorneys, commitment defense, a member with lived experience, a chief of psychiatry, the commissioner of DHS, Jody Harpstead, as well as the attorney general for the state of Minnesota, Keith Ellison. The priority admission report made it very clear that not one system stakeholder could meet all of the needs. The population the committee is aware of, just so you're aware of, are people that are civilly committed, that are languishing in our jails and in our hospitals. It was a consensus that the problem of lack of access and capacity existed prior to the creation of this law in 2013, and it persists today. The task force recommendations that we are working on that are some are incorporated within the DE1 include 9 recommendations. And I'm going to read through those so the committee knows. And I don't know if we made available the task force report, but I most certainly can send that to the chair after this. But it's to begin immediately increasing capacity of direct care and treatment facilities. It also is to form a joint incident collaboration group to help actively facilitate discharges for the DCT patients, approve the exception of the priority admission law, create the implementation of the new priority admission law criteria for direct care and treatment, increase access to services provided in the community, provide funding to administer mental health medications in jails, and relieve communities of some costs for, or counties, for some costs for individuals waiting to transfer to other DCT facilities. It also works to expedite Minnesota Section 1115 waiver application for individuals in custody, which I know Chair Noor is also working on, and it increases forensic examiner accessibility. Now, I want to be clear, there are separate bills for many of these things. We are incorporating them into this larger bill because that is the work of the task force. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like, the work is obviously continuing, and I would like to move to the testifiers.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. We will move on to the testifiers. The first testifier I have on the list is Sue Abderholden. If you'd like to come forward, please. She might. Okay. How about Ginny Palin? Yeah. There we go. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. My name is Ginny Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And Ms. Abderholden, I believe, is also testifying in another committee right now, so she'll try to. But I'm here to also help support some of the positions in here. MACMAP, or our association, was one of the members listed, and I participated in the task force. The task force was put together, and MACMAP's representation was to help represent the community side of behavioral health services in that continuum. The task force, I think, and throughout their discussions, determined that this problem is very large and very comprehensive and consists of both internal as well as external care capacity issues and concerns. The task force also agreed that the solutions to civil commitment admissions must also be comprehensive and address both the inpatient and community services upstream and downstream to them. Yes, Minnesota does need more inpatient capacity, both for our state-operated services as well as our other community-based hospital services. And we need to invest in our community-based services to prevent situations that we can from becoming so acute that they need inpatient care, as well as supporting the capacity to discharge clients to more residential or appropriate care when they need to move to less intense settings. The proposals in House File 4366, including the DE1 amendment, include several key recommendations included in the task force report to solve the capacity gaps in our community-based behavioral health care services, of which I am most qualified to speak to for my part in the task force. These include fixing and increasing our Medicaid outpatient rates to sustain existing community-based services, streamlining our behavioral health regulations to remove client barriers to care, increasing and supporting investments for first episode psychosis, as well as early bipolar disorder grants, and funding resources. Sorry, is my time up?
Yep, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned, try to keep testimony to 2 minutes,
like,
I approve.
Shooting us.
Go ahead and wrap up.
The task force report and the House File 4366 represent a large collaborative work across a diverse group of partners trying to address all of these issues with statewide impacts. We look forward to continuing to work with you. We ask for your support of House File 4366. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and for your testimony. Next on the agenda is Ian Heath. If you could please come down. And then after Ian Heath, we have Terrell Clark. And once again, please try to limit your testimony to 2 minutes, please. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ian Heath. I'm a forensic psychiatrist. Started my career at the Minnesota Security Hospital for 7 years prior to moving on to Hennepin Healthcare. I've been at HCMC for 17 years now and am the senior medical director. I essentially come to you today as a representative of HCMC and Hennepin Healthcare Systems, but I think our experience could be generalized to many other metro hospitals. You've heard kind of the history behind the priority admissions law, but it's, in essence, what this has created is a roadblock so that we are unable to discharge patients from an acute care hospital like HCMC to direct care and treatment facilities. I wanted to give you some idea of the patients that we're caring for and some brief facts. I realize time is very short, so I will try and make it succinct. We have patients in the hospital now for 600, 700 days. Literally years is our length of stay for some individuals. It is untenable. These individuals, some of whom are committed as persons who are mentally unwell, dangerous to the public, require a level of care that is greater than what we can provide. I have immense respect for the Minnesota Security Hospital and the colleagues I work with in the forensic division. I know the quality of care they can provide. These individuals require that level of care. Having them essentially locked in a community-based hospital, acute care hospital for years on end without the ability to engage in the treatment that is necessary to advance their care and subsequent decrease in level of custody is shameful in some ways. It also causes us to forego admitting 50 to 70 people who could have used that bed in the time that that person has occupied that one bed. We deal with frequent assaults. One individual at the hospital has assaulted over 120 times, 59 workers. You get an idea of what we're facing. We are wholly in support of the idea of granting an exception to the priority admissions law to allow 10 patients to rapidly move from community hospitals into direct care and treatment beds, and we support increasing capacity as well as increasing services throughout the system. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you for taking the time to be here, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I have Terrell Clark. Thank you. If you'd like to come down, please, Commissioner. And then next after that will be Danny Ackard. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is Terrell Clark. I'm currently serving as the board chair for Stearns County Board of Commissioners. I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and MACSA. I was the AMC representative to the task force. And because almost everything I wanted to say will exceed your 2 minutes, know that we will follow up in a letter. Wanted to take the time to thank Representative Edelson on working with us and the task force to make sure that we get through this session the actual key things that are going to start making a difference for the people who are most greatly impacted, those with the highest acuity needs. Not everything is in this bill. As Representative Edelson said, we're going to keep working on that together. There is urgency needed to expand our state-operated system, the capacity as well as the community capacity to meet the needs of those in jails, languishing in jails, as well as those in hospitals and in community. For us, really, the key recommendation here is any change of the statute needs to be linked to increased capacity through the state and community. And we are going to continue to keep working on that. There are a couple other very specific things that relates to counties in here. We'll follow up on the recommendations, specifically in the increase of the beds. One of the key priorities is currently counties are picking up 100% of the cost for individuals when an individual is determined not to meet medical criteria for placement. But who they're waiting for that next appropriated bed when there is no available bed due to the lack of capacity in our system. We have no control over how or when an individual is moved between the state and the facilities, and counties shouldn't have to be depleting local property tax funded behavioral health budgets to cover this cost. The task force also recommends any does not meet medical criteria costs paid by the counties. You'll let me finish this one, right?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should be redirected from the current pathway, which just ultimately ends up in the state general fund, instead returned to the counties to expand the scope of the mental health services to facilities to support individuals and communities. Most of the other items, we'll go ahead and send it to you because Representative Chair Neuer is here. The MA waiver, the 1115 waiver, right now the language is referring to a particular group of people. There are a couple of states that have requested a waiver to include pretrial. If we really are wanting to solve this, that would be something that the feds could help us with. And Mr. Chair and members, thank you, and I'll be around for questions.
Thank you, County Commissioner Clark. And what I would ask is, when you send the letter, if you could send it, the information straight to my committee member, Nick Strumalinger, because then you can get it to everybody and also post it as part of the public testimony on the website.
That would be perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here today. And next I have Danny Ackert. Please come on down, have a seat. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here in support of House File 4366 as amended. In 2023, patients across the state spent roughly 195,000 avoidable days in hospitals simply waiting for the right level of care to become available. The unprecedented number of avoidable days is due to multiple factors, but unfortunately comes at a time when admissions to state-operated treatment programs is at an all-time low. Minnesotans who should be treated in a state-operated program often require disproportionate attention and care in community hospitals, including strict security measures best suited for state treatment programs. As a result, community hospitals are often too often providing care in unsustainable situations where multiple assaults on staff are occurring, which requires unit closures, limiting care for many to keep other patients and staff safe. As such, MHA supports many provisions in the bill, and today I want to highlight support for the following. First, the immediate admissions exception for 10 civilly committed individuals waiting in community hospitals. This will immediately place 10 patients in the appropriate care setting and free up community hospitals' resources to serve more patients. It will also reduce violence and staff harm and begin to address the ever-increasing number of avoidable days across the state. Second, we support the new medically appropriate priority admission criteria, which will shift the admissions process away from the patient's location towards the patient's care needs. This centers the patient and prioritizes limited resources based on best medical practices for care. And third, the foundational rate increases for community mental health services, including hospital rate increases. The rate framework will help prevent reliance on crisis care and limited hospital capacity, and it will increase capacity in community care settings. Those settings which were discharges from DCT need to go and hospitals. Rate increases will also better support the desperately needed mental health care workforce that the entire state needs. We look forward to working with Representative Edelson, key stakeholders to advance this bill. Action must be taken in 2024. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Thank you for being here today. Are there any other testifiers that would like to address the committee? Not seeing any members. Representative Key, oops, excuse me, just a moment. There's, yes, thank you. If you'd like to come down, please. Welcome. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Elliot Butai. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota, and Sue is tied up in another hearing. So I'll just share some of the things you heard a lot of, some of these things on Monday in a bill that focused on prevention, intervention. Those things are the things that keep people out of jail, that keep people out from getting into this position. Also, just a reminder that a lot of people, when they hit this priority admissions time, when they get to the 48-hour law, they've already been in jail for several months. And before that, they had family members who tried and tried and tried to get them help, and it came to this. And I answer a lot of those calls at NAMI of families that don't understand what it means that their loved one's incompetent. They don't understand why they can't move forward. And the common theme is, why, oh, why would we ever put someone who just needs help in jail and keep them there? So the only other thing I would call out in the bill is there's a paying for medications in jails and also making sure that there's no co-pays for the psychiatric meds, which is really important. And we do know stories of people that come out of jail with thousands of dollars of fines for their medications. And also we know people that just won't take their meds if the choice is paying a co-pay or saving that money to talk to their family on the phone or buying something from the commissary. So NAMI's been a part of drafting the bill, and yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony, appreciate it. With that, we will then close the testimony and move on to member questions. Representative Keel, I believe you're the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, are we going to hear this bill again? Being there is some conversation about changing it?
No, it'll be going from here. Next is public safety, judiciary, health, and then human services finance. So it's got a number of committee stops that it'll be going through. So it won't be coming back here, but it'll be in human services finance for the final stop. And then health will also hear this bill.
Oh, okay. So are we, do we have a fiscal note requested for this?
Yes, okay. It has been requested.
All right. So I've worked on civil commitment. This is a major task. I think it was 5-6 years ago when we had those conversations. And I heard somebody say we don't want people to be incarcerated, but when you hear the awful stories of family being killed because the person in question was having a mental health breakdown, I'm not so sure that's horrible. I grew up visiting Fergus Falls when it was a mental health hospital, and I always think that there's a place for that kind of service sometime that we need so that we can help people to be stable. We have to remember that not everybody can be out and about because family and other people need to be protected. However, I'm not thrilled about putting people in jail. I mean, I don't think that mental health, that is part of the problem. But, I appreciate all that Representative Ellison, you have worked on. There's a lot in here that needs to happen. But I would say, I can ask you a question, but we still have the finances. And I'm very concerned about this and that we are able to actually fiscally pay for this. It disappoints me that we don't have any of the funds because I think we need to address a lot of what's in this bill. So I'm not disagreeing with most of it, but I'm very concerned about how we're going to cover this and care for it. So we can talk later offline too. So.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Keel. And I will mention that, the finance is going to be looked at when it gets to the appropriate committee at that point in time. They'll have all that information lined up because it's important that we're making sure that we're having the funds that we need in a sustainable way to make sure that we can fix the system going forward. Next, I have Representative Backer.
Yeah, and thank you. One of the things I think everybody would agree, or most people in this room, is we do have to stop criminalizing mental health. Mm-hmm. That is important. My question, what behavioral health rates are changed, impacted by this bill?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. I think maybe Ginny. Sue Abderholden is here now. I'm going to phone a friend. I don't. Listen, I will tell you, my job in all of this, I'll be very honest, is making sure that there are 18 stakeholders. We are meeting twice a week, and I am making them meet twice a week, that it will be a consensus bill. Okay. And I want to thank staff for making sure we get all these timelines. Representative Keel, you and I, I did the civil commitment bill with Sue Abderholden as well, and also the competency attainment. We did get something done there. That was very expensive, but I do think we are going to get something done here. And Director Grom is here to answer your question.
Director Grom from DHS is here. Thank you for coming down. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and please answer the question. Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Christy Grom. I'm with the Department of Human Services. So the rate study that is in scope for this bill would include all of our mental health rates, physical health rates, and some of our substance use disorder rates as well. I believe the plan would be to prioritize some of those rates that are most in need of addressing. So for substance use disorder, I believe we're going to be looking at residential services in this bill. And we are in the process of providing technical assistance to make sure that all of the language matches with the intent in the fiscal analysis.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Backer.
Yeah, so I'm assuming, and thank you, and I know there's a lot of rates in this, but when with the health rates, I'm assuming if, I know we're not on the financing, but the rates would increase and not decrease. That's the intention of the bill. So the counties are not, and the property tax owners are not footing all the the majority of the bills. That's the intent, correct?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The goal is to increase the rates. And then also, the one thing I think the county has really talked about, which they really care about, is the provision, which is the cost individuals are waiting for transfer to a DCT facility. So they are currently covering all the cost on that. Mm-hmm. So that is absolutely something I know the counties want. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Freeman is definitely doing his job because I hear about it often.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Becker. And then finally, we'll go to Chair Knorr, and then we'll go to the vote.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson. I think this is an important issue. We created a task force last year so that we can have a comprehensive plan. So I just wanted to say thank you to the task force for their recommendation. We've got a lot of work to do. And for the topic of the, does not meet criteria, I know we funded the counties for at least this cycle, the budget cycle, but we need to look into how we can provide that support to the counties so that they don't have to incur the ongoing cost. So we've got a lot of work to do. Hopefully by the end of session, we will have a bill that will address the needs when it comes to priority admissions. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Representative Edelson, any closing comments, and would you like to renew your motion?
Closing comments are I will probably see you in the next five committees. So we'll look forward to seeing you, Chair Knorr. And thank you. I just ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson moves to re-refer House File 4366 as amended to the Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say by saying nay. Motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Next on our agenda is we have a presentation from the Office of Addiction and Recovery in the Department of Human Services on peer recovery services and legislative solutions. We'd like to welcome to the committee Director Jeremy Drucker, who will start off the presentation. What we're looking at is about 15 minutes for the presentation, which would allow about 10 minutes for questions from the members here. And with that, Director Drucker, if you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jeremy Drucker, and I am an assistant commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget and the Addiction and Recovery Director for the state of Minnesota. In this role, I chair a sub-cabinet of eight state agencies, including the Departments of Human Services, Health, Education, Higher Education, Public Safety, Corrections, the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and Minnesota Management and Budget. And just for a quick point of clarification, it's 15 minutes for both of us. Is that correct?
Together. Right?
Okay, great.
So it's not a half hour for both of you.
I can turn and burn. I just wanted to make sure I knew how much time I had. Okay, thank you. I would just say also, too, I am a person in long-term recovery, and prior to my current position, worked closely with RCOs in a volunteer capacity, so I'm very familiar with what they do and how they operate and how important they are to the recovery ecosystem. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today regarding peer support and recovery community organizations. Peers and RCOs are vital components not just to our traditional treatment and recovery system, but also in the adjacent spaces where substance use is prevalent, such as homelessness, child protection, and corrections. Peers are recognized nationally as essential to creating comprehensive continuums of care that put people and communities at the center of recovery journeys. Nationwide organizations like the National Governors Association and SAMHSA identify the critical importance of peers in recovery and overdose prevention, as do statewide initiatives like the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness Justice Plan to End Homelessness, as well as the Governor's Advisory Council on Opioid Substance Use and Addiction, which also identifies peers as key to ensuring an effective treatment and recovery system for all Minnesotans. While there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm around peers and their potential, peers are still an emerging profession that has yet to fully realize that potential. As the profession continues to evolve, they're still relatively new to the treatment and recovery space. And recovery community organizations, which are one of the primary sources of training for peer support, are also relatively new. Peer support specialists are individuals with lived experience in recovery who provide non-clinical recovery support to other individuals experiencing substance use disorder. Peer support specialists help others by removing barriers to recovery, connecting people to recovery resources, providing emotional support, helping clients focus on the present and the future, and a lot more. Peer support and recovery community organizations are vital components to filling gaps in and around treatment that traditional clinical settings often cannot address. Peers and RCOs also, I would add, emerged out of grassroots community-based movements that were deeply embedded in the communities they served, and many RCOs continue to operate on that principle today. whether anchored within a geographic community like Mankato or Rochester, or a cultural community such as the East African or American-born Black community, RCOs provide an essential service to those in need of support and a sense of belonging. By operating in non-clinical environments, RCOs and peers offer a unique form of assistance that conventional treatment modalities just cannot provide. As we worked, I'm going to skip over a brief history of recovery community organizations and peer support and just get to the end so I can turn over to my colleague, Christy Graham. But I just want to say, as we work to integrate peers more fully into our substance use continuum of care, I think there's still a lot of work to be done in realizing that full potential that they haven't quite realized yet. And I would say specifically, the profession is still developing leadership. We need to continue to support the development of the peer workforce through ethical recruitment, quality training, continuing education, livable wages, and opportunities for advancement. We also need to create the right regulatory framework to ensure peer support and RCOs flourish and that program integrity can be secured. The two go hand in hand. You really can't have one without the other. And so I look forward to partnering with this committee and other members of the legislature and identifying the best way to move forward in strengthening peer support and RCOs so that we can maintain this critical services for Minnesotans. And with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague.
Thank you, Director Drucker. Ms. Graham, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please, or your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Hello again. My name is Christy Graham. I'm with the Department of Human Services. So the presentation, members should have the slides in their packet and you see them on the screen, that I'm going to go into is really sort of building off of what Mr. Drucker was talking about and hopefully setting the stage for some of the conversations the committee is going to be having about legislative ideas that Representative Frederick, Representative Edelson are bringing forward this session. Dive right into it. Really, as Mr. Drucker mentioned, peers play a really critical role in the substance use disorder continuum of care. These are non-clinical services that support people before, during, after clinical treatment. They're really sort of a wraparound service, and they offer an opportunity for people to develop a level of trust with a peer that they might not have in a clinical relationship. So people might, for example, be at a place in their recovery in stages of change where they're not ready for treatment, they don't want treatment, or they might have environmental factors happening where they might have a family, they might have a job that's, you know, really important to them, and they might not be ready to go into treatment. So peer services can also play a role there where the service can help support that person in that point in time. They can develop a relationship with a peer and then hopefully build on that relationship to a place when they're ready to go to treatment where they are able to make that transition. As Mr. Drucker mentioned, peer services are a relatively new concept, especially in the medical assistance or Medicaid model. This is true for both mental health peer services, for recovery peer services, family peer services. There's other peer services that states provide that Minnesota doesn't, and these are really, really new services. They're growing into their best versions of themselves, really evolving into the model that they need to be to best support the community. So at DHS, we, as you know, are always thinking about continuous improvement, about reforms, about how we can ensure people have better access to peer services. So last session, members might remember in 2023, guided in part by a report that was done by the Results First area of Minnesota Management and Budget, the governor and DHS put forward a series of reforms, and many of those were passed and enacted by the legislature, and we got some additional funding, so we really appreciate that. And just as a reminder, some of those reforms including codifying in law standards for recovery community organizations who are MA-eligible peer vendors, really making sure that we're aligning with national best practices and that we get those standards in law. We modify the certification process slightly to make sure that that peer vendors either had a certification through ARCO or through the statewide based RCO that Minnesota has just recently created. We are moving forward a change to allow counties to provide peer recovery services. This is really important for our justice involved populations. So that change is not quite implemented, but we are working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to allow for that to happen. And then we were also looking at integrated training and certification requirements, ongoing training funding to make sure that the quality of peer services is improved. And then lastly, we got some new funding for culturally specific recovery community organizations. That was something that, in particular, the tribal nations and urban American Indian communities voiced to us that there needs to be more culturally specific services for their communities, given the pretty egregious disparities. And then also last session, the legislature, you all asked us to consult with the community, to work with our partners, and to really make some recommendations on what more can we do to enhance oversight of this service, and what needs to be put in law. So through that process, over the interim, we've been working with a contractor, many, many individuals in the community, organizations, doing interviews, doing surveys, and through that work and kind of our ongoing work with peer recovery service providers, we do have some recommendations. That will be coming out soon in a report. Those are just getting finalized right now at the department. And so those are some of those ideas that we're working on, are what I'll be walking through today. And there are some specific recommendations in that report. Probably some of those can be things that we can work on this session. And then some of them are longer term conversations. There's a lot more of continuous improvement that we need to do. So the topics that we're really focused on right now at this moment, and you'll see a lot of these reflected in the bills that are being heard today as well, our program and documentation requirements, billing clarifications, identifying medical necessity, or something that we often call utilization management, and then of course we have some technical and conforming corrections, which we often do in a policy year just to make sure that authority is clear, and that both DHS and peer recovery service vendors are understand what the expectations are of them. So moving into the first bucket of ideas that we are interested as a department of working with the legislature on, hopefully codifying some of these into law, the program and documentation requirements being the first category. So first of all, we want to make sure that, and this is a requirement that other states have, it seems pretty straightforward, but it's just not something that we've had in state law before, to make sure that an individual recovery plan is made for recovery community organizations and for counties who are providing peer services. This is similar to an individual treatment plan that is currently provided in substance use disorder clinical services. And it would include things like a person's recovery goals, all of the resources that the client or the participant needs to meet their goals, maybe some barriers that they might have to their identified goals, activities that the peer and that the participant are gonna be working on, and then the plan frequency of sessions. So this is a plan that we envision as something that is very person-centered, very specific to the person and their needs, and is completed within the first three sessions of meeting. And then every time an individual or a participant meets with their peer, we want to make sure that there's documentation of that meeting and how it corresponded to all of the goals in their individual recovery plan. The next thing that we're looking, hoping to work with the legislature on in terms of codifying things into law, is requiring that recovery community organizations, peer recovery service providers, are keeping participant files. So we want to make sure that there's the comprehensive assessment, which is the assessment that authorizes those services in the person's file, and all of the documentation of the visits that they have and the goals that they're working on. Next, strengthening standards to become a recovery community organization, MA vendor of peer recovery services. This is something that we're building on from last session. So we did have a series of maybe 10 to 11 standards that we used based off of national standards that we codified in state law. And what we found in working with the community and reviewing these standards is they're not tangible enough in some cases for us to really verify that a program is meeting the standards. So we have some technical clarifications that you'll probably see and Representative Edelson's bill coming up as well. And then lastly, we want to make sure that all recovery community organizations that are providing peer recovery services meet all of the standards in law by January 1st of 2025. So there are a handful of organizations that were approved by the commissioner and may not have met the ARCO certification or the statewide recovery community organization certification or the standards that are set out in law. And we want to make sure that that there's equity there, that all of those organizations are going through that process. So the next bucket or category of ideas that we're hoping to codify into state law is related to billing clarifications. So first of all, we want to make sure that all of the peer recovery services are provided according to the individual recovery plan and really tying those things together. This is a really great means for sort of sorting out where there's maybe ambiguity or gray area around recreation, for example, where if it's in someone's treatment plan or the recovery plan that they want to use yoga to improve their physical health symptoms related to being in recovery. But maybe they have some trepidation of going to their first yoga class. Then it could be appropriate for a peer to accompany that person to a sort of recreational or health event. And so that's an important facet that we feel we need to put into law to create more oversight. interactions. We're hoping to that those are face-to-face interactions and that for each interaction, there's a discussion about the peer recovery plan. No billing for group activities or transportation. So this is, I know, something that's been a big discussion in the legislature and in the peer community. And I think our position for the department right now is that we're just not ready to go there. So we have been exploring other models. We've been working with the National Center for Peer Excellence and looking at models, for example, where maybe you could provide up to 10 participants. You could have Rhode Island, for example, has two different kinds of groups. There's recreational groups, structured curriculum groups. There are additional requirements for the peers that are facilitating those groups. So there could have be required to have additional certifications, training and motivational interviewing, additional years in recovery to be able to do those groups. And I guess another thing on the group facet that came up earlier in committee that we are considering is what would that group rate be? So we are in the midst of looking at what our peer, what all of our mental health and SUD rates should be. And we know that both our peer recovery rates, our mental health peer rates are, I believe our peer recovery rates are about 90% below where they should be. And that's an important issue that we need to address to make sure we have appropriate access. And so when we're looking at group rates, we want to have the right rate in place based on a larger group. It would be probably a different rate, similar to something that we do in mental health rates. So that's a conversation we're hoping to have in the future. And then same thing with recreation. I know that's been a topic of discussion as well that we'd be happy to engage in. We have been looking at some other models across the country and how other states are doing it. And then moving to the next bucket, clinical necessity or medical necessity, sometimes called utilization management. So we are hoping that maybe we could look, use a similar model that we use in our clinical services called utilization management to review up to 15% of all claims to determine that medical necessity was met. And so that's something that I believe we'll be talking about with Representative Edelson's bill. We would also consider engaging in conversations about whether there should be a weekly hourly limit. And then lastly, we really do need to codify in law that if all of these billing requirements are not met, that that providers can be subject to monetary recovery if those aren't properly paid. And then lastly, technical and conforming changes. So we have some name changes with regard to ARCO that we need to clean up and a few just kind of cross-references and statutory reorganization items that we need to do. Lastly, I'll just say community engagement is really important to us. So we know there have been a lot of community conversations. We'll continue to be a part of those conversations. We'll be working with Mr. Drucker and his office, the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, with Representative Baker, and all of the members on that council, working with, I mentioned, the National Center for Peer Recovery Excellence. There's a lot of work that we need to do, and it needs to be done collectively. And I think that's all I had for you. So I will wrap it up here, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Super. Thank you, Director Grom. Appreciate the opportunity to learn more what's happening and what are some of the changes that may be coming forward. The first person I have on the list is Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. When we look at some of these recommendations that you have around billing clarifications, out of curiosity, how are audits done? How frequently is billing looked at? How do those pieces occur?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I'm thinking that we might want our Office of Inspector General to answer that question. I'm not that familiar with how our audits work.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. If you could please introduce yourself and respond to the question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General at DHS. And Representative Hicks, your question is, we are doing audits and investigations based on tips that we have in, which is primarily how we receive them. We're also in the process of setting up more data-informed or data-driven audits and investigations, and we'll be setting those up as well. But right now, we're more investigations-based, based on referrals and tips, and are moving more into randomized audits and from there, investigations.
Yeah. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And please forgive my ignorance, but in the 245D space, because it's a licensed program, there are regular site visits, license visits. I know that, that's different in this space. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding, is there any, does everybody get a visit at some point? Is there any frequency in which those occur, like every 5 years someone's going to come out, or every 3 years, or every, like what does that look like? Or is it only purely based on tips?
Go ahead. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, unlike our licensed providers out there where we go out and do regular visits, like in the childcare space where we're out there on an annual basis, others were out there to every 3 to 4 years, that doesn't necessarily occur for those that are unlicensed. So right now we are going out if we have, through our Program Integrity Oversight Division, if we have a reason to suspect some things, either it's a compliance visit, we're just finding out some more information, it's an investigation that we're launching, or if it's an audit. But that is only if we have a reason to go out there right now. Because it is not regulated or licensed, we don't have those regular visits.
Thank you, Inspector General. Representative Hicks.
Nope, that answers the question. Thank you.
Other questions that people may have? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I just a good presentation today, Ms. Grom, and to Mr. Drucker. I think a lot of people know here that this is a space that we really all are working hard on getting it right. Excuse me. We're still building up this model of support recovery. We've had a lot of struggles and growing pains, and we've had some questions about how we are spending those dollars appropriately, and we really need to take a good step at this. I think some of these things, like Ms. Grom said, we can do quickly. Some are going to take more time, and some we're just going to have to kind of weed out some of the players that are not helping us as well. So we are working hard on this, and I just want to again appreciate the efforts in a really bipartisan fashion in this space. So this is an important issue that I will continue to work with, and I really want to thank DHS and the team. And we've got more to do. We got to keep pushing it because time is lives, and that's what we have to remember. So let's keep at it, and thank you for the time today for doing this. So it's a good move.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to investigations, I know that I'm not going to ask you to comment on anything active, but out of in the RCO space specifically, I was curious about what types of complaints that you have received in the past, what those look like, if there's any common themes in that space. Again, not asking about anything that might be active, but things that have like come to a close. If there are anything that comes to mind that you could kind of share with the committee of what those might look like.
Inspector General Moti.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Fredericks, this is a new provider type for us, so we don't have as much information, and I don't have that with me here today. So if we're able to provide that to you, we'll be able to do that. And the reason I say if is that if it's a smaller amount, then it could be easily identified. So we want to be able to de-identify and give you those broader buckets. If we're able to do that, we're happy to follow up and provide that information. But I don't have that with me today.
Representative Frederick. Okay, very good. I want to say thank you to the department for being here today and for the presentations and for the work that was done last year. I know that there are some areas that in terms of client load, et cetera, where there was some pushing going on, and appreciate the department taking a look and doing some different things and coming back now with the recommendations that I'm expecting Representative Baker will be bringing an amendment to one of my bills on going down the road. And I appreciate the collaborative work that we've had on this. I know it's not easy, but it's something that this is a bipartisan issue that we're all working closely on to make sure that we're helping our people who've got addictions going down the road and creating the systems that are going to make them successful. So I want to thank the department for all the work and look forward to moving on to our next bill. Thank you, everyone, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 3397. This is a Representative Edelson bill. If you'd like to come down to the table, and if you'd like to move your bill, please.
Oh, yes, I would like it to move to,
Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Human Services. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 3397 to Human Service Finance.
Sorry, very good, Representative Edelson. And I understand you have a director's amendment. It's a DE amendment, I understand. If you'd like to move your DE amendment and explain it, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would actually just like to move the DE2 amendment and hoping the committee will just accept it, and I'll talk to the overall bill then.
Sounds very good. Any comments or questions for the author's DE2 amendment? Not seeing any. All those in favor of approving the DE2 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and House File 3397 is amended. If you'd like to go ahead, Representative Edelson, and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3397, as amended, goes to address the many concerns that have been raised around peer recovery services. I want to make very clear that peer recovery services overwhelmingly are being done in a very positive way in the state of Minnesota. There has been some reports, which many of us know, and I want to thank Representative Fredericks and Representative Baker for their collaboration, as well as the many stakeholders that are here today and some that are not, to address this issue, and specifically also Director Grom at DHS for all of her technical assistance on the bill before you. So the bill before you seeks to do many things, and I'm going to walk through all the different aspects of the bill. So what it does is it adds mental health professionals to provide supervision. Right now it's licensed and alcohol drug counselors, but there's no reason, I'm a clinical social worker, there's no reason I couldn't do that as well. So we want to make sure that we're expanding this so that there's more supervisors in the field. It adds more details and puts individual recovery plan, which Director Grom just talked about, with the expectation that a client is receiving person-centered care. Make sure that a recovery organization must meet requirements set forth by ARCO and MARCO, so the Alliance of Recovery-Centered Organizations, as well as the Minnesota Alliance of Recovery Community Organizations. It's one or the other. It adds language to ensure organizations have practices that support LGBTQ plus communities. It allows for the billing to, allows for the first two billings to be billable to Medicaid to create the individual recovery plan. So for instance, when we do therapy in the therapy world, we are allowed up to 4 visits. Somebody can come to my office, I'm able to provide them. We work through and do all of the background information, and I'm able to bill for that up to the 4th visit where I have to, at that point, do a treatment plan. This just makes that match up with what we're seeing with peer recovery services. Right now, they cannot bill the first 2 visits. That's not right. So it also makes clear that any additional billing outside of the 2 hours a day, the 14 hours a week, will need to be approved by the Department of Human Services. It adds a review of the commissioner of 15% of all claims to ensure that they're medically necessary. Thank you, Representative Hicks, for all of your questions there. I think those were very good. It requires that a client receiving services must do so voluntarily. And they must be provided notice. There has been a lot of discussion about people receiving services for peer services. Again, not by all, but by some, where they did not know they were being billed. They did not know that the services they were receiving were actually being billed to Medicaid. That is not okay. A person should know when they're being given treatment and when they're being billed. So it also requires vendors to keep a file on each client, just like we do in pretty much any other therapy world where we bill in Medicaid. And I will just say that many people already do something like this already. It also creates a tiered reimbursement rate. So what that does is right now, so we're saying face-to-face, so it's one peer to one client, and also one peer to 4 clients. So those are the 2 that we're establishing rate systems. What we have heard is happening is there might be back-to-back billing. So there might be 5 a peer that might be with 5 people or 6 people, and they're billing them back-to-back as one rate. That should not happen. So we, again, in the clinical world, if you are doing group therapy, it is a different billable rate that is less for each client or patient. So that is what we're establishing here. So 1 to 4, we don't wanna, I think one of the biggest problems is when we hear that there is maybe something that is happening that is maybe not good. One of the worst things I think we can do is limit the practice entirely. What we're providing for are legal frameworks for people to still get the care and access to health that they need. So it also establishes a working group and on various topics. I know the department had talked about they want to eliminate transportation, but I would just say that I caution this committee to do that. I think that is bad. I think we can limit it. We can make sure it's involving the treatment plan. But imagine, like, we just last session addressed PCA services were not billable during the time the person was getting care. I don't think we want to create barriers to care here. And I just, as a committee, I'll ask that you support me on this. And I think that is it, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Very good. Thank you, Representative Edelson. I do realize we have a few people who'd like to testify. Our first person is Wendy Jones. If you'd like to come down, please. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. If you'd like to introduce yourself, let us know who you're with and begin your testimony, please.
Excellent. Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Wendy Jones. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Alliance of Recovery Community Organizations. There are numerous language tweaks and amendments in HF 3397, and I'm testifying broadly in support of these changes. I know that other testifiers will speak more specifically about amendments regarding peer recovery support services. And I have to confess, I'm a former public historian, so I have to give a little background here. In 2018, Minnesota added peer recovery support services to the Medicaid benefit set. And unlike other states, Minnesota expanded vendor eligibility to include recovery community organizations, or RCOs. RCOs had introduced the first recovery peer training in Minnesota in the early 2010s. RCOs had been providing peer recovery support services here long before they were added to the Medicaid benefit set. So the logic, why not let them bill for the service that they had originated in Minnesota? So the intent was to ease up some of the funding pressures on RCOs, which are non-clinical, grassroots, scrappy, boots-on-the-ground nonprofit organizations that never turn away someone who needs help. So if RCOs could access Medicaid funding for the people who qualified for reimbursement, then they could use more of the grants, donations, other funding sources they depend on to help all the people they serve who don't qualify for reimbursement. For example, people who aren't enrolled in MA or don't have an official diagnosis but still need help, or family and community members seeking support to help others. Medicaid reimbursements could free up precious resources for RCOs that they needed to perform all the other critical community services that they provide. So this bill addresses some of the confusion that has ensued since 2018. There was not really good knowledge of what RCOs are, what peer recovery support services are, and they have not been universally understood to date. So the bill includes multiple options to become certified as RCOs. It further clarifies the criteria based on national standards that define an RCO, and it clarifies the grievance process for organizations that feel that they were denied certification incorrectly. And so I think we all know that building Minnesota's recovery ecosystem will always be a work in progress. But the modifications in this bill bring us closer to a shared understanding of RCOs and peer recovery support, and closer to having those robust policies in place that promote their long-term effectiveness. So thank you for letting me speak today.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. Next on the agenda, I have Randy Anderson. If you'd like to come down, please. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members, for allowing me to testify today. And thank you, Representative Edelson, for all your hard work on this topic. My name is Randy Anderson. I'm a person living in long-term recovery. What that means to me is I haven't used any alcohol or drugs or mood-altering substance since January 9, 2005. I'm also a state-licensed alcohol and drug counselor, Minnesota Certification Board-approved trainer and supervisor for peer recovery specialist. I'm here today to testify in full support of House File 3397. I know how invaluable peer services are for those seeking or already in recovery from substance use. According to the data released by SAMHSA in September 2023, there are 29 million adults who perceived that they ever had a substance use problem. 72.2% or 20.9 million consider themselves to be in recovery or to have recovered from their drug or alcohol use problem. That means there are 20.9 million solutions to recovery from substance use disorder. Just imagine if we could harness that population and their knowledge to help others struggling to find or sustain their own recovery. Guess what? We can and we have. With the proper training, education, supervision, and oversight, we can turn lived experience into tools that guide and mentor others. Up until now, peer recovery services have been a bit of the wild, wild west, with very little guidelines, accountability, or oversight. This bill starts to address many of these problems, and it definitely is pointing Minnesota in the right direction. Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members, for your time and attention on this very personal and important topic.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony. Next, I have Brandy Brink. Very good. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Yes. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Brandy Brink. I am the founder and executive director of Beyond Brink, a recovery community organization with multiple locations in the state. I am also a woman in long-term recovery. My testimony is going to be specific to recovery support service requirements, as my colleague Wendy Jones has spoke to other parts of this bill. None of these provisions are radical and in fact align with best practices. Adopting these will provide clarity and direction for new and emerging recovery community organizations in our state. Today, Beyond Brink is a relatively large provider of peer recovery support services, serving 40 counties over the last 7 years, both through grant funding and Medicaid reimbursement. In 2018, when Medicaid reimbursement became available to organizations like mine, I had a staff of 2 part-time employees and I myself was not on our payroll. In order to show up in the most ethical way possible in this new space, we sought the guidance and direction of RCOs in other states, national organizations, DHS, SUD providers, and third-party accounting billing systems. At that time, there were very few established policies and guidelines and resources to help me implement these services. I am grateful that Minnesota has evolved and grown in its support in the implementation of peer support services, where we can put this knowledge into practice. The provisions being introduced today align with best practices in the field. Previously, emerging RCOs had to learn this through the assistance of others. We adopted these practices even prior to our first submission for reimbursement and use these practices even when we are not submitting for reimbursement. This bill provides much needed clarification and guidance for organizations like mine was years ago. This is a big step forward because it removes some of the guesswork and burden of always trying to find someone to clarify and provide guidance for you, and it puts in front and center for everyone to formalize. These amendments ensure that small community-based organizations, like I was, can hit the ground running to set up their delivery services without facing the confusion and barriers that I did. It will help all organizations be better from the beginning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brink, for being here today, and thank you to the testifiers. Is there anyone else who would like to testify before the committee on this issue? Not seeing anyone. Members, any questions or comments? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. And this may be a question for DHS. I was just reviewing the bill, and it talks about being an eligible vendor. And I'm curious, what is the process to become an eligible vendor?
I would say that's a phone a friend type of thing. Ms. Graham? Director Graham, excuse me? If you'd like to introduce yourself and respond to the question, please.
Mr. Chair, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services, Representative Hicks. So to be an eligible vendor of any kind of MA service, you'd need to enroll with our provider enrollment area. I'm not as expert on provider enrollment, but we can get back to you with those specifics. But in general, right now in law, what's required to be an eligible MA peer recovery provider, that's an RCO, you need to go through either one of 3 certifications through ARCO, through CAPRIS, or through the new Minnesota Statewide Recovery Community Organization. So you need to be certified, and then you need to also meet a series of best practice requirements. And if I'm not answering your question exactly, happy to modify.
Representative Hicks.
No, I think I really appreciate that answer. I would just really like to know, what is that provider enrollment process that you said isn't your expertise area, which I totally understand. I would really like to understand that process better. Mm-hmm. I think that would be helpful for me. So if I could get some information about that. I don't know if anybody else on the committee has questions, but I would be very interested in just understanding that process.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, we can certainly get back to you with more specific information. I don't want to misspeak and say something wrong, given that it's not my area.
Thank you. We'll look forward to the information. If you could make sure to also share it with Nick Strummel-Langer, and then he can get it out to the entire committee.
No problem.
Thank you. Representative Hicks, any other questions? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, just a shout out to Representative Edelson. Thanks for getting us all together many times to work on this bill, to get it better. I really want to thank the folks that testified today, too. They're, like Randy Anderson said, this is personal. This is personal to people that have this life journey of getting it right because it's so complicated, and the community that we're trying to help is so fragile, and there are 20 million different people in that recovery world and 20 million different ways of getting there. It's different and it's personal and it's important we get it right. What this bill does is it helps us build to a perfect product. It gives us a little bit of work support, workforce wiggle room and extra support. It has a lot more accountability to it, which is something that really has brought this to the forefront. We need a better formalized recovery plan for everybody. Billing transparency is super important. And again, just smarter and better reimbursement plans. You know, with group plans, individual plans, we're building a better product here. So just, Rep. Edelson, thanks for being one of those that really gets this. Because of your career move, you understand it better than a lot of us do, too. And again, this is a day when I just want a heartfelt thank to my great friends out there that are living this every single day and be willing to carry us part-time legislators that want to do right by listening to you better. So as Ms. Jones would know, I've listened to you more and more as time goes on. We didn't always agree and see things, but I am certainly understanding it a lot better today, and I just can't tell you guys how much we appreciate all you do for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Well said. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get some clarifying sections here. Line 5.12, when it talks about publicly available recovery community organization code of ethics, is that something that is available right now publicly, or is it something that we're aspiring to get?
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, I'm going to we've worked on so many aspects of this with so many people. Director Graham, did this come from you, or was this
I think I see some fingers in the background there pointing to, I believe Ms. Jones might
Ms.
be able to help.
Ms. Jones, thank you. I was thinking it was you, so thank you. Okay.
Ms. Jones, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Noor. That is part of the national standards for recovery community organizations, that they have a code of ethics and a grievance policy that is grounded in recovery principles. The idea behind that is that you're not just taking something from a clinical provider, but that you have those policies and those grievance policies that acknowledge the lived experience of the people that you are serving. And to have those publicly available is another way that we have a check and balance on the fidelity of that operation. So that comes directly from national standards. Whether or not that's happening everywhere, that's what's going to be rolled out as more and more organizations go through a formal certification process.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jones, if that can be sent to our committee administrator, Mr. Strummel-Langer, that will be appreciated so that we have something to review. Another question that I have for Representative Edelson, is there any cost associated with the working group that is being established in this bill?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department would be the one that would leading it, so I imagine there would be some small costs to that for staff time. But I don't know exactly what that estimate would be. There will be a cost in terms of the rate that is in this bill, though. So in addition to the working group, there will be a cost for the rate for the 1-to-1 and then 1-to-4. So But I will say that I think actually it will be a savings to our state, because there is a lot of how things are being built now are not accurate. And I think there's a lot of confusion on how to bill. So while we might be initial cost, I think there will be a cost savings. But I don't know if the department has an idea of how much working groups cost.
Is there anyone in the department that might have an answer on that? And from what I would understand, there's probably also a fiscal note that's going to be accompanying this by the time it gets to your committee. So Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. Yes. So I think the question was about potential costs around a working group and maybe around rates. There potentially could be some costs there. Our budget director had to be off in another hearing right now, so we'll probably have those discussions in the Finance Committee. I would say that the utilization management typically has a small cost as well to amend our contract with our current vendor that works on identifying medical necessity and reviewing for it. So there could be a few costs in here, Mr. Chair and Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Director Graham. Chair Knorr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that those who are participating in the working group are reimbursed in terms of the services that they're doing and Chapter 15. So I'm hoping that it can be included in that section. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Thank you, Chair Knorr. With that, not seeing any other questions, Representative Edelson, would you like to offer closing comments and renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my testifiers really said it. We were trying to build on and build up this profession, definitely not tear it down. So we will continue to provide guidelines, and I thank Representative Baker. I just really want to thank you for your support, and Representative Fredericks as well, and all of our testifiers. Just so much gratitude for them.
Well, thank you all for the hard work that everyone's been doing on this. Representative Edelson moves to re-refer House File 3397 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and House File 3397 as amended is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. With that, we are moving on to our final bill for the day, which is House File 4548 from Vice Chair Frederick. If you'd like to please move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 4548 be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Would you like to please explain your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would say that I'm going to be brief in my bill introductions. I'll just say that it does two things. One is it really builds on the work that Representative Edelson did as well, and I cannot give her enough appreciation for the work that she has shown in this space. And this bill does two different things. First is it builds on the framework that Representative in the previous bill, but it also acknowledges that if there is a bad actor, if there is a bad experience that somebody has, how do we address that? How do we put a safety net in play? And so some of the first parts of this bill is about setting up an ombudsperson for people to have that centralized person to go to for them to advocate for these changes. And I want to give a shout out to the Office of the Mental Health and Disability Ombuds Office. And this language is not perfect. It is not meant to elevate the SUD space in above any of the other great things that they do. And so there will be some changes in regards to the ombudsperson language. But it is intended to create a person for those that are in recovery to go to should they have some concerns. The other part of this bill also kind of establishes a best practice that individuals that are peers are not independent contractors. And to make that case, Mr. Chair, I would just turn it over to testifiers.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. With that, we'll go to our testifiers. The first testifier I have on the list is Ms. Wendy Jones. Welcome back to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here today. Please reintroduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Wendy Jones. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance of Recovery Community Organizations. I'm also a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder, which I neglected to mention last time. So I am testifying in support of HF 4548. Specifically, a section of this bill amends the qualifications for recovery peers. I just want to note that that change was not initiated by Marco, but by members of this committee, and we're really grateful to the work that the committee is doing in addressing this issue. We've submitted written testimony in support of it from a broad range, 29 organizations that are either established or emerging recovery community organizations, and so I won't belabor that. But I do want to add that not all the voices are at the table, and I know this is an iterative process, and in due diligence, I do want to acknowledge that we do need to hear from other organizations, including ones that currently do use independent contractors to deliver their peer recovery support services, and that we do need to hear from peers who have been employed in that capacity. So again, recognizing this is a start, not an end. To that end, the support that we have for this practice, it comes out of national practice. It comes out of the work of SAMHSA, of the Peer Recovery Center of Excellence, for the National Institutes of Health, which all speak to the importance of peer recovery support services being embedded in a supportive, recovery-oriented environment, and that they are reciprocal, that they equally support the peer and the person receiving the services. The second part of my support for this bill comes from the tweaking of the ombudsperson language. And to tell you a little bit that MARCO, the Minnesota Alliance of Recovery Community Organizations, is a new organization. Through a competitive RFP process, we were awarded funding by the Department of Human Services to establish a statewide agency that would provide technical support, professional support, mentorship for all these organizations that are trying to become recovery community organizations, but also to provide a certification process that could check that against these national standards. And so MARCO was formed by recovery community organizations. We've just launched our certification process, which grew out of a broad stakeholder engagement process. And it's a multi-pronged process that starts with a self-assessment, where we then help organizations get ready to go through that application and identify those areas where they need to work on what it really means to be an RCO. It will be a peer-reviewed process by entities who are not affiliated with MARCO, and the decision-making will come ultimately from the reports from that, which are being checked against the criteria in state statute, and there is a grievance policy in place. So MARCO is prepared to work with the ombudsperson's office to address any complaints that may come forward against RCOs, and we are building a structure to ensure that we don't get those complaints. That's our ultimate goal, is that we do have really strong organizations that are providing these authentic peer recovery support services. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Jordan Hansen.
I think he stepped out.
Okay. Oh, Jordan Hansen, you're up. Welcome to the committee. We just caught you coming in the door there. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. I'm Jordan Hansen. I'm a person in long-term recovery. I'm also the CEO of a company called Your Path. We do virtual care for people with substance use issues, trying to fill the gaps. I'm the executive director of the Recovery Policy Alliance, which is a new advocacy group trying to affect change that's accountable to the communities that we all serve. And I guess, you know, relevant to what we're talking about, my best friend died of an overdose in 2019. And the people that we have assembled here today, including members of the committee and all the people in the audience, have been working on this for a very long time. I'm trained as a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. I run a company that employs physicians and nurse practitioners and all the other clinical and medical things. The single most helpful thing that we can offer our community is through peer recovery services. It's not close, you know, and this comes from somebody that I'm trained in this other piece. So when I look at Farhay and I look at Wendy and Brandy and Beth and all these folks, this is the best chance we have to really try to address the issues that are affecting our families and our communities and in ways that are, you know, disparate. You know, we continue to see horrific gaps in outcomes for people of color compared to their white counterparts. we need these services to be helpful, and yet we need this bill or bills like this to try to help us have guidance. When we look at the protections that are afforded full-time employees, those things are really, really important to people who are at high risk, including people who are in early stages of recovery. Substance use disorders are a chronic illness, and just like any other chronic illness with a behavioral component, there are return of symptoms. And if somebody does not have a workforce protection where they don't have insurance or they don't get benefits or they don't know where the next paycheck is going to come from, they're put in a position where they have to make choices. And these choices are oftentimes between feeding your kids or showing up, you know, compromised to a job. And so when we look at this bill, I think it's a great step forward for providing protection, not just for the communities that we serve, but also for our workforce. So really appreciate your work, and thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hansen, for your testimony. Next, I have Randy Anderson. Welcome back to the committee. Thanks for being here and sticking around. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you again, Chair Fisher and committee members, for allowing me to testify today. And again, thank you, Representative Frederick, for working on this bill. My name is Randy Anderson. I'm a state licensed alcohol and drug counselor, Minnesota Certification Board approved trainer and supervisor for peer recovery specialist. Most importantly, I'm a person living in long-term recovery. What that means to me is I haven't used any alcohol, drugs, or mood-altering substance since January 9, 2005. The peer recovery workforce has experienced significant growth in recent years, primarily due to its proven effectiveness in aiding individuals struggling with substance use to find and maintain recovery. However, like many professions, this workforce is not immune to challenges. Frequently, both peer professionals and community members reach out to me with concerns. Yet, it can be exceedingly difficult for them to identify where to report these issues. The addition of an ombudsperson and a single point of contact for reporting and investigating concerns could greatly alleviate this problem. Many individuals entering the peer workforce as a means of giving back and bolstering their own recovery journeys. Often, these individuals are in early stages of recovery themselves and may be particularly vulnerable. The provision within this bill, which prevents a peer recovery from being classified as an independent contractor, not only serves to protect potentially vulnerable individuals from predatory employers, it ensures Minnesota's compliance with the updated U.S. Department of Labor regulations aimed at preventing employer misclassification. On January 10, 2024, the Department of Labor released a statement as part of its new guidance, asserting that, effective March 11, 2024, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a worker is an employee and not an independent contractor if they are, as a matter of economic reality, economically dependent on the employer for work, regardless of whether they sign an independent contractor agreement. With this in mind, I am confident that this measure will effectively safeguard the peer workforce. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, I have Brandy Brink. If you'd like to come back up forward, please. Thank you for hanging around. If you'd like to reintroduce yourself and begin your testimony,
yes,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Brandy Brink. I am the founder and executive director of Beyond Brink, a recovery community organization with multiple locations throughout the state. I am also a woman in long-term recovery. I am here to testify in support of House File 4548, the provision that peer recovery specialists can no longer be independent contractors, and the creation of an ombudsman for greater oversight, transparency, and protection of those engaged in peer support services. Peer recovery specialists are a vital part of our workforce in the recovery community. However, I do not feel it is best practice to allow these individuals to work as independent contractors due to reasons of ethics and supervision and for the purposes of their own well-being, safety, and financial health. I believe the classification as an independent contractor lacks a sufficient structure of supervision. As an employer of a team of 29 peer recovery specialists, I cannot overstate the value of frequent supervision in this profession, which helps peers make better decisions, grow as professionals, and grow in their own personal recovery. I believe requiring peer support workers to be employees, not independent contractors, will better protect both the peer and the recovery receiving services, leading to better supervision, reduced vulnerability, and ultimately better protection and support for all people pursuing recovery from substance use disorder.
Additionally, I'm here to advocate for a substance use order specific ombudsman. Although I believe there's more work that we can do in this space, the creation of an ombudsman would establish an office for greater oversight, transparency, and protection. People in recovery from substance use disorder are often a vulnerable population. We have been subject to stigma, discrimination, and mistreatment in many facets of our society. Due to this evolving nature of recovery services in Minnesota, we need this advocacy now. Thank you for allowing me into the space and for your support on each of these bills that I believe will lead to greater protection of people seeking recovery from substances and better protections and standards for those we serve.
Thank you, Ms. Brink, you. For your testimony. Finally, I have Beth Elstad. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Appreciate you coming forward. If you could please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Elstad, and I am the current chair of the Governor's Advisory Council on Opioid Substance Use and Addiction. I'm also a founder of Recovery Alliance Duluth, the first RCO in Northeast Minnesota. I'm one of the founding board members of the MARCO, and I'm also a licensed alcohol and drug counselor and approved supervisor. I'm most proud of the fact that I'm a person in long-term recovery with over 27 years of sustained recovery, a mother of two adult sons, one who uses his experience in the community today, and the other I carry with me in heart. We lost to suicide while in recovery while he was nearly 2 years sober. So that story is really what grounded me in the need to co-found a recovery community organization in Northeast Minnesota. So thank you for your time today. I'm here to express my full support in the House File 4548. I believe in the importance of an ombudsperson in their role to investigate and help us to resolve issues. They promote and they protect individual rights. I have used the office in different capacities throughout the years, and it's often very effective and most helpful to resolve really complex issues. I know that when I dug into the Ombudsman Office of Mental Health and Development of Developmental Disabilities, they do provide some coverage for folks with chemical dependency so that it's there. But I'm here to say that we're not aware of that. There's very minimal exposure to that. And so folks like me and leaders in the recovery community have really felt challenged in where to bring our concerns, our issues, forward for the past few years. So with that being said, I want to say thank you that you are there. We just need more exposure, and I'm in full support of standing up an office that creates an ombudsperson specifically for substance use or merging the title behavioral health, whatever we have to do, but we need to continue to do more. The types of concerns that I'm speaking about specifically are more related to harm being caused to individuals, the predatory practices that we've seen that have happened in the community, people being restricted access to services because of their use of medication in their recovery, people being denied the access to medication for use in their recovery. These are some of the issues, and there are so much more. We know there are billing issues. We also have to look at the harms that are being caused to people and their families. And so I just want to say I indicate my full support in the House File 4548, the advisory council that I chair with the Governor's Advisory Council for Opioid Substance Use and Addiction. We did make a recommendation to stand up an ombudsperson for substance use and recovery. And so although this may not stand up an office alone, it's really important that we start, and this bill is just a perfect place to start. And so I want to say thank you for your work, and we fully support you.
Thank you, Ms. Elstad, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify and address the committee? Not seeing anybody? Members, any questions or comments?
Thank you.
Seeing none, Chair Frederick, would you like to offer? Excuse me, Vice Chair Frederick, if you'd like to make any closing comments and renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to address, I just want to flag for everybody, there's a letter in your packets that was signed by almost every single RCO in the state supporting this. And I cannot highlight that enough, that in the work that went into this bill and the work that Representative Edelson done. It has been about, and the work that Representative Baker has been to all of the meetings that both of us have been hosting, and that it has been about community that we have all done. All three of us have really focused on raising the voices of the people doing the work, and I just want to give a huge shout out to everyone who is supporting the recovery community. So with that, I would ask for the committee's support and renew my motion to refer House File 4548 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Very good. Representative Frederick moves to re-refer House File 4548 to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and House File 4548 is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Frederick Edelson, Representative Baker, for all the work that you folks have been doing in this area. This is important work and looking forward to you folks continuing it. With that, our next hearing will be on Monday, March 11th, where we'll be hearing six bills from a variety of authors, and we'll have remote testimony available on that day also. Seeing no further business for the committee, we are adjourned.